Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Evolving to Exceptional podcast. I have Steph Barron here with us today. She's an HR executive and VP of Human Resources. She has had an incredibly interesting and insightful and impactful career history, and her insights and inspiration are going to, I think, bring you tremendous value. So I'm looking forward to this conversation today and some of the topics we're going to talk about around the vulnerability and the need for vulnerability in terms of HR and our HR leaders, as well as how important it is to bring that fun or that play to work. Steph, I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself, to tell our audience just a little bit about who you are, how you got to where you are, and why it is that you do what you do, why it is that you're passionate about this people and human resources function that you've been in for your career.
Oh my gosh. Let me start off just by saying thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm excited to be here and look forward to spending the next hour or so with you and with all those that are listening. I actually fell into HR. I actually started off with a strong operational background and then leaned into training development, which grew into an HR function. So I didn't start off in that being my preferred background or career choice, but that's just where I think my journey has led me. And I will share, I'm oh so fortunate and I feel lucky to have been in the spot that I'm in today, to have the ability to connect with others. It's a privilege and honor to be there for employees as they work through their individual journeys. To share, I have a master's degree in social work with an emphasis on human behavior. I've been in HR for over 25 years. And as of late, I've leaned into more of even the career development side of things, of hiring the whole human and what that really means. And spending my time over the past couple of years working with leaders to help transition them from management to leadership, to focus on employee retention, career pathing, and helping organizations be as successful as possible through the actual team member themselves.
So when I hit on something you just said, because I think it's really impactful, and that's the hiring the whole human. And I'm curious if you could elaborate a little bit on that and what you mean by that and what that looks like.
Sure. So when you think about, for those of us that used to have back in the day when there were stacks of resumes on our desk for that one position, and you were lucky if you got that call back. And then just not even through COVID, but just through evolution, things have evolved in the workspace where even as early as 5 years ago, there wasn't an Uber or a Lyft or someone doing your shopping for you as an opportunity for additional income for your family or a side hustle or Pinterest or whatever the case might be that exists today. So the market has become saturated with opportunities. Smart people do smart things, right? Risk takers step in and try their risky stuff. And as a result, that's made it more competitive for employers as well as HR professionals to find the right talent. We all know that who we are isn't always who shows up at work. And so over the last several years, society, health and wellness carriers and professionals have leaned into we're human. We have more divorced employees now than ever before. We have blended families. We have single parents that by the droves. We have drug abuse, alcohol abuse, and all of those things exist while employees have to work and maintain household. And so realizing that if we can meet somebody where they are and we hire them holistically, I think it's done a couple of things for me professionally. I've had great success in employee retention and loyalty and commitment from them to become a preferred employer where I am today and previous places, because that is life. Those are things that happen, and it doesn't stop the need to work and earn a living.
So one of the things I think I've talked about a lot before is that in the past, we almost treated employees as if they were just parts of a machine, that they were just interchangeable parts. We describe their jobs and we move them in and out in order to fill or execute those tasks. And I think what's interesting is this shift to really treating them as human beings and really treating them as holistic humans that have all the things you just mentioned, all the things going on in their lives that are causing them challenges and stress and how those things are impacting them. Tell me a little bit, Steph, about what some of those experiences are that you've had as a human resources leader, as a people leader, that have helped to shape this approach of looking at the holistic human, at looking at all the elements that make them who they are and how they show up to work. What are some of the things that have shaped you or gotten you to this point, or have you always thought this way?
No. So I always lead with a story of when I am in front of first-time supervisors, I always lead with, if I could go back and let my first team punch me in the gut for as structured and strict as I was, I would be on the ground. I was the rule follower. I was the policy enforcer. So back in the day when I was, before I was even a baby HR professional, I was the one that held people to the company standard, what that book of policy said. And as a result, people didn't want to work for me. The ones that wanted to work for me were just as curmudgeon-y as I was. And we have to realize that people create policies because of a very small group of individuals who abuse them, right? The lion's share of humans don't want to come into work and say, I cannot wait to really mess up the policies and practices of my employer. People don't roll out of bed that way, right? And so I think even, again, there are some businesses that are still living in an antiquated lens, and there are other companies that are very progressive, and there's everything in between. Employees today aren't supportive of page 37, paragraph 6, sentence number 2 says this. They say, do you, manager, even know what your handbook says? So I talk to HR leaders and as well as operational leaders and say, the employee handbook in a big picture is used for the employee's advantage, and they'll use it to their benefit when it's convenient for them. And then they'll use it to lean on when you're not following the policies and procedures when convenient for them. So I think it all boils down to two things. Number one, do we have good relationships with our team members? If you have good relationships, the employee handbook is nothing more than just a guide, right? And number two, are we empowering our leaders to be reasonable? Do they know what it means to be reasonable? What are the parameters in which the organization can support them to make those independent decisions? And I lead with two things in mind. I want you to do the right thing, whatever that is. And as long as you can defend it, I support you. So if you lead with doing the right thing, even if it's outside of an employee handbook or policy manual, but you're doing the right thing, hopefully the conversation ends well too, right? And so I think it's a matter of evolving from, I call it parenting to partnering. So again, 10, 12, 15 years, employers were the parent. Here's what you do. Here's when you do it. Here's how you do it. Move on. Now it's, let's collaborate. They're not employees, they're team members. They're not managers or supervisors or team leaders, or they're part of a group or a pod. And so today's world, from a successful, progressive, employee collaborative perspective, people want to have an opinion. They want their voice to be heard. I'm doing the tasks day to day. Why won't you ask me what we can do to make it more efficient? I probably know better than everybody else. But historically, we were the hierarchical viewpoint. So since we were the boss, we implemented the changes as we saw fit versus what makes most sense. So I used to be that manager. I used to be that person. And really hard conversations came my way to help break me out of the mold.
So it's interesting as you talk about the history of that leadership or those phases of leadership. It reminds me of a book by Alan Watkins called the HR revolution. And he talks about the history and detail of these different phases that we went through, starting at the very beginning of work, where it was that patriarchal, that family style, that parenting that you were talking about, I'm going to take care of you, how that then progressed from patriarchal to process, to then power, to then profit, to then people. And now we're moving into this paradox world where we've got to hold and be able to hold competing views. And what he talks about that I think is really interesting, and it highlights, I think, your own experience, is that people, leaders, all leaders go through all these phases. And it's just a matter of how quickly they go through them. So as you start leading people, as you start to learn and have those experiences, you probably start in a patriarchal approach, in that parenting style kind of approach. And then you move into that process and compliance and how do I rely on the handbook? And then I'm moving into that power. Well, I'm in charge, do what I say type of model. And as you progress through those phases, you grow as a leader, you expand as a leader. And I think that for many of us, and I can relate to your story deeply, that when we start early in our careers, we don't know how to show up in that more evolved sense. And that makes perfect sense because we haven't had the experiences to bring us to that point. What are some of the experiences that you had, as you talked about, that really pointed you in that direction, that really transformed you from, kicked you in the gut and got you to change your practices or your way of looking at people and performance?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I have really three mentors that have helped me put me in a position of where I am today. And the first one is Mike Genowitz. It was back, I was a very young HR professional and he was a controller and he was very data driven and I was very emotionally charged. And so he would pull me aside often and say, "You're right, but your approach is a little bit off." Right. And so he would listen, but he was a little bit more passive. And so he would sit back, but then when appropriate, he would step in and provide feedback. My father, without question, has been a huge focus and influence of shaping. He was the one that was arrive early, have class, have polish, sit back, pay attention, and things will happen over time as they're supposed to. And then lastly, and probably most recently, that's had the most biggest impact in the last 10 years is Mark Learman. And he is a leader who is soft-spoken and observant and quiet, but looks out for his group or his team. And when they're doing really well, he celebrates it in a very quiet way. And when there needs to be a tweak or modification, he is intentional with it. And it was never a 180 degree about face. It was always that 5-degree turn because he had the forecast and the forward thought of where he wanted people to be. And it was a wonderful focus and a wonderful approach for me to be able to say, okay, I want to hear what he has to say because I felt as though he had my best interest in mind. And I think it wasn't a matter of managing, rather leading. And it's leaning into that, hey, I want to help you versus let's stop doing this, let's start doing this. And so it's that engaging and really truly investing, which is the long-term play. That's the marathon. That's you're not on the Autobahn in a car. You're walking the walk. Right? You're talking the talk. And those 5-degree modifications, those 5-degree adjustments make people feel as though you are investing in me. You do care about not just what I'm doing, but also who I am and how it's impacting me and how you can help me be successful. And I think those three key individuals in my professional, personal experiences, you pay attention to those, you watch others and what they're doing well. You take note and maybe peel a little piece off, put it in your pocket and pay attention to it. I've also been successful by screwing up a lot, right? And so I have fallen down more times than I care to share. But today, because of recent things I've done in addition to just HR, leaning into vulnerability, I am more comfortable with that today than I've ever been before. And 18 months ago, I would have never, ever had that come out of my mouth. I think it's a leaning into and meeting people where they are, and also showing your vulnerability to employees or team members so they see that you're human, not just a title or not just a department.
Well, and I think that you hit on something really important there, in that there's this almost sense, and I'll speak to myself, I won't speak on behalf of all HR people, although I would be curious to ask, but in my career, this sense of I need to be right. I need to know the information. I need to be the expert. I need to be the one who brings the answer or the solution, or the, when you're early in your career, this need to be the person that everybody turns to. And so admitting when you don't know something, or admitting that you maybe need support or additional help or additional information or resources can be, I think, difficult for those in the HR function.
I would tell you that it was difficult in my personal life, my professional life, and everything in between. Particularly, I was a young supervisor. So I was managing, right? People that were twice my age, that were older to be my parents. And so when you think about, and then that's one factor, is being a young professional leading those that you're junior to. Number two, the element of responsibility. So when you're young, that responsibility equals power. And so that power is misused oftentimes, even if you're not young. But then on top of it, to add the HR element of the compliance officer, or the, not the people person, but the rule enforcer, or whatever key side title that's been given. I've coined the phrase of HR is what I do, not who I am. But for so many years, that power play, that's what fed my belly. And then all of a sudden, I found people didn't want to confide in me. They didn't want to reach out to me when they needed something done that was hard and heavy, termination, suspension, litigation, depositions. They were coming to my door ready to rock and roll. But when it came to talking about someone's wedding, a college graduation, kindergarten for the first time, loss of a loved one, they weren't leaning on me. They weren't sharing with me because they didn't find that compassionate side that I didn't display, because I was who I was portrayed and behaved with what I did. And I think that was for a long time career limiting for me, but I didn't realize it until later on in life when I went through experiences personally that I now relate to people so much more than it actually has done. Now that I've had some of those tough moments in life, it's actually done even more good today than ever before by being vulnerable and realizing that people don't want to be, who wants a boss? I don't want a boss, but I want somebody who can, hey, Steph, do you have a second? Is this an HR conversation or a Steph conversation? And to have that trust and that rapport for them to say, just a Steph conversation. And I say, okay, that's great. And again, HR is what I do. When you go to work every day, you don't say, I'm going to go talk to operations. You're going to go talk to John or Joe. You don't, but today people still say, I'm going to go to HR. I would rather people say, I'm going to go see Steph for a second. I'll be right back. And people know, oh, that's what Stephanie does. That's not who she is.
I love that. And one of the ways that we talk about this from the neuroscience perspective is that we are always evolving human beings, that at our core, I am an evolving human being. And that means that I'm always growing through limitations, challenges, issues, experiences, my encounters with other people, and the encounters I have in my environment. And I think what often we've lost sight of, or potentially lost sight of, in terms of the HR function or the people and performance function, is a focus on fixing or improving, or somebody's not whole as they are, they're incomplete, there's something wrong, there's something missing. And so instead of looking at us all as ongoing, improving, continuing to change human beings, that means we're never in a done state. We're never in a, I've got all the answers, I've got it all figured out. We're never in that state, whether we're an HR leader or another type of leader. That allows us to be more vulnerable. That allows us to engage in those types of conversations more easily, because we're not trying to hold some standard. Instead, we're acknowledging and having conversations around, how do we keep improving? How do we keep evolving and growing? And when we take it to a neuroscience perspective, there's nothing wrong with how you're created or you're wired. Your nervous system, your brain, all of your neural pathways wired together perfectly to meet your needs, to serve your purposes in the best way that your body and brain knows how to do it. That doesn't mean it can't do it better. That doesn't mean you can't intentionally create a new neural pathway. You absolutely can. And you have to do it intentionally. You have to make that choice to be different, to show up differently, to engage differently, to evolve the way you perform differently. One of the terms you used a little bit earlier that I really liked was the term partnership and being a partner. And we use that term too as looking instead of leaders and managers as people managers, but instead as performance partners. And looking at those conversations as, how do I help support this person to improve their performance outcomes? And when you can look at it from that perspective, I think then you can bring in that holistic piece. Because if I'm ignoring this person's going through a divorce, that's certainly impacting their performance. So we either need to deal with those emotions and figure out how we navigate and manage them in the workplace, or those emotions are going to deal with us, right? They're going to get in the way of the performance.
Absolutely. And you bring up a great point. When you come back down to HR, in many cases, and again, I would be interested to hear what other HR professionals listening to this podcast believe, but there is, in my experience, an understanding of HR is the end all be all. And that just simply isn't the case today. But that there is a perception, and I still need to think woven cloth, of a large portion of the workforce to say, oh, HR is over there on an island. We are all over here. And I always, every chance I get, I share with my team, I work for you guys. I'm here for you. If you aren't successful, if you aren't supported, I don't have a role. Right. And I also believe that people work so hard to have work and home life separate. And we often share our moments and our stories and our experiences of where it's become blended and where it's become muddied and where it's become bloody and where it's been redefined. And I think one of those big things is the cell phone and social media, right? When I started in the workforce, there wasn't social media to see all of my indiscretion, thank goodness. But today, that's just part of the process. But I think it's important to realize that when we have somebody who's dropping in performance, to your point, and if we don't manage it, it'll manage us. More importantly, I think about, I've been through a divorce. I've been through the death of a parent. I've been through things with my family that other employees have. And for years, I never talked about it, because I felt as though that was taboo, and I had to present perfect, polished, ready to go at all times. And again, there's a benefit and a strength to that. There's also a significant disconnect and a falling out from that too. Employees don't come to work wanting to ask for money alone. Employees don't come to work wanting to come in and fall into your chair and cry because they're exhausted because last night this happened. Employees don't want to show up and look anything other than well-kept and well-prepared for the day. When your life is crumbling around you, we have two choices, either lean in and extend a hand, or we can sit and watch. And I've been both types of leaders. So I don't join you today for one moment and say one's better than the other. I give credit where credit is due. My shortcomings and my really poor choices historically had put me in a great place today because I learned from them. I learned the hard way, but I did learn from them. But today I talk about it. I had days where I couldn't afford the bills. I had days where I couldn't afford groceries. I had days where I didn't want to be at work and I had to because I had a mortgage to pay. So for years, I didn't share that. And now I look at people and say, let me share with you my story. And when I find myself sharing my story or my moment with them that's relatable, all of a sudden that shield of I have to go in and see HR and it's perfect and I'm going to keep it very sterilized and very matter of fact, they're in my office bringing me pictures of their kids' event or their spouse or their milestone or whatever, because I become more relatable and real versus a department.
I couldn't agree more. And what comes to my mind is, as I reflect on my own experience and my own unwillingness to share the struggles that were going on. And for me, those struggles were what led up to my burning out and having to leave my former workplace. And I've reflected a lot on how I had to show up. In doing so, I showed up very inauthentically, right? I was very inauthentic in how I was showing up because I was trying to appear as though I had it all together, what you just described, right? Everything's fine. I've got it handled. I think I was even maybe trying to convince myself a little bit that everything was fine, everything was handled. But I think at the top of that is the potentially with not just employees at large, but with other leaders. And I'm curious of your perspective on the relationships you have with your CEOs or the other leaders on the executive team, because HR plays such a critical advisory role and support role of this fear that if you allow them to see part of you or to know your weaknesses, that you won't be able to progress in your career. You won't be able to accomplish the things that you want to accomplish. And I think especially with HR leaders in smaller organizations, or maybe it's the first time they're an HR director or a manager reporting to the CEO, that can be exceptionally stressful and difficult to navigate or know how to navigate. I'm just curious of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that is a fantastic topic to talk about. A couple of things. I've been wildly, radically unsuccessful in my past with connecting with key executives because they did have what I felt and thought and believed to be the perfect world. They were married and 2.5 kids and everything in life was just pristine and perfect. And I was trying to not burn toast. And so there comes a point in time where I've had unsuccessful relationships with senior leaders. And it's because I wasn't vulnerable. It was me. I have to own my piece. And to your point, Jessica, is it's hard. And if you are an advisor of a group steering the ship, you can't look flawed. You can't have a hole in the boat, because if that's the case, they actually might throw that dinghy out and go find a new one. And so what I have found today through making those mistakes of appearing perfect and all of a sudden things are crumbling, because there does come a point in time where all of a sudden you have to bring somebody in at work and say, there's some things that are going on. And again, it's a very humbling experience. I was going through a divorce and the owner of the company at the time didn't know for 18 months that I was ever even going through a divorce. For 18 months, I had no idea. And it was because I was petrified to look anything less than perfect. And that just could not have been more unhealthy and the wrong way to show up every single day. And today I welcome people to be who they are. But back to the key C-suite perspective, what I've learned today is what I would tell those that are up and coming C-suite folks or those leaders that are going to that next level is work with those other key members one-on-one, right? Get to know them and have conversation, have coffee. So today there's 7 of us on our, what we call our panel. And all of them have very unique stories. I have one leader who has more than one marriage and the kids from before and after don't necessarily have a great connection. I have another leader who is not strong in change. And so that becomes a conflict. And so why would we want to bring that up in public? So having those quiet conversations and having the relatable discussions of, I've been through divorce, I like control. So how do we make those intimate connections? And then when you're at the table, all those little intimate connections, all those little intimate relationships become very cohesive very quickly. And it takes effort on our part. It's no one else's responsibility other than mine to build rapport and build a relationship with all those senior leaders. So we do, they look at me as a trusted advisor and me them. That's why I feel as I found that to be successful, but I didn't know how to do that originally. And I finally went to my internal colleagues and said, how can I be better aligned with leaders? And I would just watch. And then I would, again, it was me also leaning out to other HR professionals saying, how do you get along so well with your CEO? What is, how does that dynamic work? And I think today's world, particularly in the St. Louis area, we have so many HR venues and melting pots of fantastic talent that want to see like-minded individuals blossom and be supported. And so I think reaching out to like-minded business partners in different businesses, but in your same footprint of HR, and say, how did you do that? How did that person do that? And I will share a very dear friend of mine who was a senior HR leader, and I won't say who it is, but if she listens, she'll know exactly what, she'll know I'm giving her a quiet shout out. But she leaned in and said, I was at a, we had our entire leadership team had a business advisor who sent me to tell our story. And this business leader was the CHRO, and she said, I'm not telling my story. I've had a terrible story of personal things outside of work. And the outside vendor said, you have to tell your story to become more vulnerable. And she's telling me this story because I am not naturally good at being vulnerable. It is kryptonite. And she shared that she stood at the podium and her hands were shaking and she was crying, telling her story to a very small group of people. And she said, Stephanie, at that moment, I never had more connection with that group of individuals than any other group of professional individuals my entire career, because we all shared and showed up authentically and we shared some of our flaws that we had never shared before. And so I think it boils back down to, are you leaning into those and building that trust factor to have those solid relationships, to be able to be that trusted advisor at that C-suite level, or for that matter, at any level, right? That's what makes someone be talked about, be thought of, and be celebrated.
I think that's such a powerful testament and story to the impact and the creation of connection that comes from being able to show up authentically and as your true self and as who you are. And when we think about, from a neuroscience perspective, our gut brain, where we have neuron and neural networks in our gut, is one of its functions, and one of the functions that it's responsible for is both safety, action, and our core identity. And so when we're not showing up as who we really are, when we're hiding and covering and trying to pretend things are okay when they're not okay, then it's going to hamper and hinder our abilities to take action, which you can bet is going to impact results in the workplace. And you said something earlier that really stuck out to me, in that when you talked about when you're not talking about things and how things can go on for a really long time before you become aware of them, because people are keeping them secret, or they're not sharing about the experiences that they're having or what's going on with them. And what it made me think of was how, as you don't share, some of those issues can grow. And whether it's substance abuse problems that continue to grow and expand because there is nobody there for that person, whether it's limiting beliefs or whether it's relationship challenges, or there's, you could come up with a whole host of things that, if resolved, if there was a space to share and gain support from and work through those challenges, would create a different result in that person's life and limit the long-term impacts or the long-term negative impacts that might come out of not addressing it or not putting it on the table and having that person have to show up and keep all those things hidden or under wraps or whatever you want to say about them.
Which ties to performance, which ties to attendance, which ties to not showing up for your work or whatever the case might be. And again, it's, you have a couple of different types of viewpoints. You have leaders that say, I don't want to get involved, that their personal business, I'm going to stay in my personal space, and I'll let that, if they need something, they'll come to me, but I'm not going to engage, right? There's that type of leader. There's the HR leader who is very much, hey, what's going on, and gossipy and too involved. And there's also the individual leader who says, we're here to do a job. I don't care what happens. You need to be here and show up and do your thing and go home and handle that outside of the office. And I think that there's varying degrees of things in between. And I've been known to be overly compassionate to a fault. Then I give people the wrong impression that I'm too available for them. And again, that my pendulum has swung both sides, extremely structured and very direct, to giving people too many chances, and where's that balance? And again, it boils down to when you're in an HR capacity, trying to lead, coach, guide others, you have to know who your audience is and be able to have the emotional intelligence to pivot with who's in front of you. So if I have a group of engineers, the chances of me being really touchy-feely with them and then reciprocating is highly unlikely, right? So I call those guys, I had a group of engineers that worked together, what they called the war room. And I would walk by every morning and I would smile and go, hey, good morning, guys. And they, not one would ever look up at me. It was, their heads were down. They're like Mozart on a keyboard, just would not move. And then one day I got a chat that said, good morning, staff. And I went, oh, I broke through. I was just communicating with them the wrong way. So then I would walk in and I would send a chat, good morning, everyone. And then I would get acknowledged, right? But I'll share with you, engineers have a hard time talking about what's going on in their life. The lion's share of them are quiet, soft-spoken, introverted, focused on the programming and data, shut down and go on. And you have customer service team members who are very chatty and very social, and they share a lot of things with each other, sometimes too much, right? And so how do you take that, find that balance as an HR leader, as an ambassador of the business, and to represent the brand and support the legacy of what the company stands for while maintaining integrity and longevity within the workplace?
Well, I think what's interesting is when you think about, I like to say that there is no barrier in the brain between the workplace and your home life. There is nothing that separates how your body and your brain is working to produce results in your life, both at work and at home. They're intermingled together. And
have you ever been told, don't treat me like I'm an attorney. I've been told, don't HR me. I'm not one of your employees. And so that it happens. We don't mean for it to bleed over one or the other, but it does.
It does. And what that means, I think that takes it even further, is often the issues that we see or the challenges that we have in our personal life are also reflected in our work life. And that the root issue of that challenge, so whether it's relationship challenges, whether it's a dysregulated nervous system where people are very reactionary in their response to other people, if that is happening in a relationship in the workplace, it's also happening in the relationship at home. It's the same root issue that's occurring in both places. And so when you can gain a bigger picture from people about the challenges that they're experiencing and you have that level of trust, then you can actually get to the root of the issue. And I talked about this in my SHRM talk last week, of that how often we stop at the behavior when we're looking at an issue. So we don't like an action that an employee's performing or something that's happening. So we're like, okay, what behavior needs to change? Instead, we have to go much deeper. We've got to go into the thoughts, the feelings, the emotions. But even below that is the rooted neural pathway, is what is in that person's physiology. How have they always operated before? And if there's a pathway or a pattern there for them, it's going to be incredibly difficult to change that by saying, set some good goals, change your habits. Well, it never works. And that's, I think, what gets to what you said towards the beginning of this podcast, is that people don't show up to work to do a bad job. I've never had anybody that I put on a performance improvement plan want to fail that plan, like intentionally show up and do a bad job. There's something that's underlying that issue. There's something that's deeper that's going on. And the more we can understand about the people that we're interacting with, the more we can help them by getting to those issues. And I think it really is a transformation of looking at the HR function as to truly supporting the whole human, the whole brain, the whole performance, the whole person, because there is no separation within the human and within their neurology and their neurobiology that separates how they perform at work and what they do at home. It's all intermingled together. And so it's a misnomer to even think that you can separate the two things.
I agree. And keep in mind, I've talked to employees who have had very challenging moments in their life, or whether it's work or homework, a combination thereof. And I walk away thinking, oh my goodness, if I were in their shoes, I wouldn't be able to function as successfully as they are right now, even at 50%. So when I look at it again, it's, and I say that a little bit tongue in cheek, I want to make sure I'm being authentic to say, I used to be that former HR leader and operation business person who judged. I passed a judgment on, if they would just do these three things, they wouldn't be in this situation. If they would just stop doing this, they wouldn't be in that situation. And so I will share with you today with conviction, that's baloney, right? I was fortunate to grow up in an environment with two parents. I was fortunate that my parents had full-time jobs and maintained a reasonable living. I was fortunate that my father had his master's in statistics, because I don't like math, but how lucky was I that I had somebody at my dinner table when I was doing homework to help me, right? And we think about today, when I have single parents in my office saying, I can't function because I'm afraid that my 8-year-old's at home by themselves and the door isn't locked. I didn't grow up in that realm. My kids didn't grow up in that vein. So for me to look at someone and say, if you would just do this, the reason why the 8-year-old's at home by themselves is because it's a single parent who can't afford childcare, right? And so, but I need them here because they do a good job. But again, their minds are foggy because they're distracted, because they're worried about the safety and well-being of their child. And so I think it's a matter of me looking at that employee and saying, have your phone on you. Make sure they FaceTime you. We have today technology today. If the policy says no phones in this area, then make sure that you go to your supervisor, have that conversation and say, for this 6-minute time period from off the bus to in the house, I need to be able to have that FaceTime conversation. So I think we as HR leaders have to remember, we don't get to say, I can have my phone, but you can't have your phone. I'm in HR, so therefore I have to be available, but you can't be available. I think we have to realize that today's world, everything we need is right here at our fingertips. I don't have to go pull up a manual. I can AI it. I can chat and GPT it. I can go to social media and find 17 articles and 19 videos on whatever topic you want to give me. So I think we have to really realize that we are hiring like-minded people who are as smart or smarter than what we are in many cases, and to listen to what they have to say. Because again, it melts away that me versus you, us versus them mentality. It makes it we. How do we become better? How do we create a better environment? How do we collectively focus on employee collaboration? What are things that we can do together? Not what can I do for you or you do for me? What can we do and work on that true, sincere, I want employees to leave work and go home and say, I had a great day because Steph asked for me to share this. I'll share a little story that we do here. So we have TV screens all throughout. And so I had one employee one day that said, hey, they went on a cruise for the first time ever. They were so excited and they were showing me pictures of their cruise. I'm like, this is great. This is fantastic. And they said, could you put those pictures on like the TV so everyone could see how awesome this cruise was? Now I will share with you, this employee was a frontline worker. They worked their tail off to be able to afford this cruise to their family. And for us to take 3 minutes out of our schedule to upload 6 pictures of this employee and the true, sincere joy that they had by being on this cruise, and they wanted to share it with their coworkers, that turned into an entire program of, I have probably 150, 170 employee vacation photos. And I actually had to reach out and say, I limited, you can only send me 3. You can only give me the 3 best photos of your family vacation, and please add a caption to capture what the picture really entails. And so again, it's not an increase in pay. It's not better benefits, it's connection. And I think connection and vulnerability and on the employee and the employer side makes the organization, the business unstoppable and competitive beyond measure.
Well, and I think that you talked about a little bit there, some of the unique challenges that people are faced with today, whether it's AI, whether it's single parent families, one of the things I always mentioned to my parents as my kids are going back to school this week for the first time is something they never had to think about when I was going to school was, would there be a school shooting? Would there be these types of things that exist in our world today that didn't before? And that has created a much higher level of stress that everyone's walking around with all of the time. And so these examples, and I love your examples of the vacations, and are such a fun way to create the connection and the compassion and that relationship with others, which helped bring that stress down, which helped to balance out the stressful experiences that we have in our lives and regulate our nervous systems and bring us back to a place of joy and happiness and positive emotions, rather than being forever stuck in our head with analysis and thinking and worry and fear and all the things that come from that high level of stress. You and I talked a lot in our first phone call about the importance of play at work and having fun at work. And I left that conversation and really spent some time thinking about that, because I think oftentimes we do think of work as something I have to do, I have to get through or suffer through it. And it's not fun and it's not playful. But when you can make it fun, when you can make it playful, when you do have those connections and you can share about your vacation, the example you just gave, that completely transforms the experience, right? It completely transforms the energy. Tell us a little bit about why you think it's so important to create that atmosphere of play or fun in the workplace.
I think it makes us human versus coworker X, Y, and Z. I think it makes us focused on being authentic and not just neighborly, but have care and compassion for others. How many times do we as a company show up for, gosh, someone's funeral at the workplace? I think it allows for authenticity. I think it builds trust. I think it helps with mental health. And so companies today, they post on social media a soccer game, a kickball game, a barbecue. That's not tied to come work for us. That's tied to look how awesome we are as a group, look how much we love each other. And certainly it catches your attention, right? It also provides employee well-being. It lets people learn from each other. It builds team cohesion and team building. It allows us to be effective as leaders. So I think we do a variety of things that just surprise. I'll share, you think about all of us have kids that are going back. Most of us have kids that are going back to school this week. I took it upon myself. We all know that social media has the back to school pictures of then and now, and here we are, and this is the next year. And employers have social media teams or Zoom or whatever our platform is internally to share employee communication. We actually said, hey, show us your kids' pictures. But before that post went out, just share to be authentic and be thoughtful and mindful, which I think is really critical of an HR and leadership team. Cool. I had a couple of employees that either don't have children, not by choosing, but by misfortune, or B, don't have that first day great back to school because it's a struggle. Mm-hmm. And so I went to those individuals first and said, hey, we're thinking about sending this message out. I know this is hard for you. Are you ready for tomorrow, or has your son or daughter returned to school? How did that go? And so because I worked really hard, and again, it's a job. You have to update policies and procedures and practices, and you have to do the trainings and the compliance, and you have to do all those things in the realm of an HR role. What you should be wanting to do that pays off in dividends in the long run is building the rapport. I can share with you and anybody that knows me in HR or not in HR that I've worked with in the past, they know that I know people's employees, that their spouses and their kids and most of their dogs' names. And it's not because I don't know cat names, because I'm not a cat lover, but I respect all animals. But I take it upon the level of, if I think about the employee that's in the office and they're having a stressful home life, and let's say it's one of my guys who travels a considerable amount of time, if I can send a note to his spouse or his or her spouse and say, hey, you're loved. Your spouse has been on the road a considerable period of time. Thank you for holding the fort down. Thank you for letting them work with us and do the things we need them to do while you're at home doing both, pulling double duty. So I think about the play part and the compassion and connection part bigger than just the employee who's in front of me. I think about that. I have an employee that's been on the road for 3 weeks. I sent his wife flowers and the kids cookies. It was back to school and he wasn't there. So I sent cookies with his dad's face on it. And it was a ridiculous face. And it was not because I wanted to. I wanted them to know that we also know that this is hard for you this week. And so we want you to eat your dad's face. Thing. And again, what does that do when the spouse comes home after a bad trip and they're frustrated, they want to leave? I'm in hopes that spouse says, hold on a second, look what your employer did for us. They stopped and made a memorable moment for us. Do you really want to look for another job, or should you go in and talk to them and have a conversation? Mm-hmm. I think those are the pieces and things that we say fun. And I agree, Jessica, they are fun. But I do that with intention and I do that with purpose because I'm hoping that I'm not looking to buy anybody. I'm looking to connect with our staff and their families because that's what makes, in my opinion, that's what makes us the preferred employer and the best place to work from my viewpoint. I had bags, cordhole, whatever you call it, based off of the region you're in. I surprised our owner and had cordhole sets made with our logo on it. He couldn't believe it. He said, I've never seen anything. This is so cool. And then at the end of the day, we raffled them off and just gave them away. And so that was a cool deal. Again, it wasn't a big deal. It was a 10-minute phone call. We have the coffee truck show up. We'll do a kickball game at the end of the day, off hours if you want to. And oh, by the way, bring your kids and your littles because everybody can play kickball. And then one day I just ordered 30 pizzas. I don't know. Again, it's not tied to work. It's not tied to you have to. I want to because we care about each other. But that just doesn't happen. It takes a concerted amount of effort. And even if you're an HR person that doesn't have that cohesion amongst the leadership level, or you're in a senior leadership position and you're not able to steer that ship yet, find the one or two key leaders and start small. Our VP of sales all of a sudden one day had his team and their spouses out to his home for dinner, washers, playing catch, listening to music, hanging out 6 to 9. That's all it was. And several of us showed up. It was very casual, talking about the weekend and what we do. There was no work talk. That team is more gelled and glued than any other team within the company. And I'm not proposing you to have people over to your home. What I am proposing is maybe you should go out and share pictures of your family with your team members or with other departments, or go out to another single parent. If you're a single parent in an HR role and say, hey, I'm having a tough time with this. Can I run this by you? And maybe take off the hat once in a while and just be who we are. And that in and of itself builds that rapport so we can have fun. So we can do cool things. Again, I'm a big believer in if you like where you work, you're not going to leave. And I think, let's be honest, St. Louis is very small, right? The school systems have done it right. The private schools in the St. Louis area and surrounding, they handle recruiting and welcome them back to school in the best way, right? We've got teachers outside front with crazy skirts on and pool noodles clapping and crazy necklaces to make that experience for the students fantastic. I'm not proposing that HR people have to be the cheerleader all the time, but we have to be able to find those key individuals who are influencers within the organization and have them be the cheerleader to help mold those purposeful moments for us to be fantastic at what we do when we're servicing our clients, whether they be internal or external.
And I think you've given so many great examples of ways that organizations can do this and the value and the intention behind doing it. And I think that for a lot of individuals, and if they have the ability to do these types of things, understanding that the impact isn't just on making people feel good, that actually there is a neurobiological impact that happens when we spend time connecting with each other, playing and having fun with each other, that creates relationship and creates smoother results. I love the example you talked about of that connection and the person who brought the team to his home. I used to, when I was a leader, especially after I brought my IT team and my HR team together, when I took responsibility for both functions, and I would have them to my house, we would make dinner, we would play games and have competitions against each other. And it completely changed the dynamic where they had been in this combative relationship before to how do we do it together? How do we rely on each other? And the organization became so much more effective at rolling out technology because the IT team would use the HR or the talent management team to make sure that to pressure test everything, to write all the instructions, to help with the training, because they could communicate it so much more effectively than the technical team could. And it made the technology rollouts just significantly more effective because of those relationships. And so I think sometimes we think of those things as nice to haves or as something bonuses that we could do or things that we could add on. But I like your point about doing it with intention, not just doing it to cover up for or make up for not paying people enough or bad working conditions or things like that, but to do it because you're going to build relationship, to do it in ways that create positive results and impacts in terms of the people and their performance.
And I think the one thing I'll share with you, and I don't know how much more time we have, but I'll share with you the one comment you just made is people aren't being paid enough. I've never talked to anybody that says, Jessica, I make too much. I'm good. We're never going to make what we're worth. And I tell them, I share that on a regular basis. You don't make what you're worth. You don't. With that said, setting that aside, what would make you feel fulfilled? And so I think it's important for us to pay attention to, if it was our company, perhaps we would write checks outside our company. So what can we do within our power, within our conviction? First, acknowledge that they don't make enough. None of us make enough, right? Who we ask it, right? I deserve 10 times what I'm earning today, right? But that's not realistic. So I think in the grand scheme of things, taking money off of the table, what are things that are meaningful? Do you need diapers? If you need diapers, and again, every C-suite or senior level team has these conversations. Hey, did you know that Timmy's having a tough time with? Hey, did you know that Susie is whatever? These conversations are had at the C-suite level, not out of a gossip or unfair or unkind perspective, but out of a, what can we do within our own foundation, in our own silos to help Susie, Timmy, Mary? What's within our power? Because I want to take away that worry so they show up and they're ready to rock and roll because they've given us back in dividends from a performance perspective. And this is just a short moment in time. And I think businesses and companies and leaders do that every single day. And why would we ever want to say you can't do that? You can't help thy neighbor. You can't help each other. We don't need fame, right? We don't need exposure. I have an opinion about people who always post on social media all their good doings, all their good deeds. I love to see people who watch it from afar and talk about it versus display it and show it. I want people to do the right, again, do the right thing. If you do the right thing, we're good. And in almost any capacity or any scenario, if you look at it and say, I did what I thought was the right thing, even if it's not what you wanted done, my answer is, okay, fair enough. I'll talk about it next time if there's a modification. But all in all, if we can get people to feel empowered to do the right thing, have fun, have a kickball tournament, go out and play local ball for 20 minutes with your team. I know that what we get in return far outweighs the 25 minutes times 8 employees on the clock.
I couldn't agree more. And I think when it comes to doing the right thing, it always trumps legal compliance. And as my background is as an attorney, and one of the things that I always said in the HR function was, if you treat people, you don't have to worry about a lawsuit. You don't have to worry about a negative outcome. And so if we focus more on how do we do right by people and how do we do right in ways that impact them in ways that will bring better outcomes for their lives, better experiences for their lives. And that's unique, I think, to every person. So I'm going to give you a chance, Steph, as we wrap this up. I think you and I could talk about this all day, but to give any final thoughts or words of wisdom or insight that you want to share with our audience as we wrap this up.
Yes, thank you. I think just the takeaways I would share is to incorporate vulnerability in the VHR practices. I think it requires a cultural shift within a company. I think leaders need to set the example by demonstrating vulnerability within themselves and encouraging its acceptance throughout the organization that you work for. I think companies can create a more compassionate, innovative, and resilient work environment that shows retention, it's more successful in bottom line numbers, and that cohesiveness that those organizations had as a result of it, you can't penetrate. It's remarkable.
I couldn't agree more. And I thank you so much, Steph, for all of your insights and your wisdom that you shared here. It is just so important, not just for HR leaders, but for leaders in general, to be willing to show up in that authentic sense of self and in that way, and be willing to be vulnerable about their challenges as well as their successes, be willing to show up as their whole self. And if you're a leader out there or an HR leader out there who struggles with this, who hasn't yet figured out how to show up in that way, I encourage you to reach out. I encourage you to get support either from our organization or another coach or resource who can walk you through why that's such a struggle and help you to unpack what's holding you back. Because I agree with everything we've said today. And I think that if you don't learn how to show up in that way, if you aren't able to show up in that vulnerable capacity, that it's going to limit your career. It's going to limit your effectiveness as a leader and in ways that I think you are unnecessary, and you really can bring greater value as a leader if you can learn how to do this more effectively. So thank you to all of our listeners for listening to this episode today. It's incredibly important and incredibly insightful wisdom from Steph today on the topic. And as always, as I end every episode, I just want to remind you all to always keep evolving, keep growing, keep looking for opportunities to expand and rewire those neural pathways so that you can live your most exceptional life, so that you can enjoy more of the experiences on your life journey as you're living your life. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and we'll be back again next week with another episode.